thanks so much, Lars, and thanks for coming. For the people that heard this 2.5 years ago, I'll let you know when the jokes are different. Everything else you can pretty much ignore. It's going to be both funny and serious at the same time because this topic, I think, demands both to keep your sanity involved. The serious part is that there's now a chorus of scientists, including myself, that think what I will tell you about is the single most important problem facing science and technology in the 21st century, bar none. Now I have to tell you in the next 45 minutes why I can defend that single most important statement. That problem has to do with energy. And I need to set the scale. So this will be three parts, and there will be no confusion about those parts because there are three different colored background slides, so you won't be able, because it's very important to differentiate what we know about the present from what we believe is a prediction of the future to what possible solutions to avoid that future will be. And those are the three different parts of this talk. I'll first tell you about how big energy is, which makes it the biggest problem by even a narrow definition of that word. And to set the scale, you need to remember this clue, the Stone Age. Now, you have no idea what that means, but I guarantee you in 15 minutes, if you're still awake, I will decode what the Stone Age has relevance to this problem. Then I'll tell you about what the future is likely to bring as a guideline to say why this is such a big problem. And then I have to decode for you one number that I want you to remember, the number that when I had to give my elevator speech in 30 seconds to President Clinton, the only number I chose to care that he remembered, and so I want you to remember 3,000 years when I decode that in about 30 minutes. And then what the challenges are. If this is such a big problem, what are the constructive allowed solutions that the physics of our planet says are places we can go, as opposed to the political situation wishing that we might be able to go in order to figure out where in the world we'll get our energy? And for that, you need the third clue that I'll get to in about 40 minutes. You need to decode Willie Sutton. And for those of you who don't know who Willie Sutton is, you'll have no idea why in the world I need him, but you will in about 40 minutes. If you want a little longer version of this talk, you can get it on my website. I have a video of a public lecture I gave in Pasadena that's on there, and there's also a transcript of it, and you can feel free to modify it as you want, and just don't credit me with changes unless you email me first, but I'm happy to answer questions. I'm not the only one saying this. Nobel laureate Rick Smalley testified in Congress that energy is the single most important challenge facing humanity today. Chemical Engineering News, our trade journal, said it's the single most important scientific and technological challenge facing humanity in the 21st century. The pundits and now a frequent visitor to Caltech, good friend Tom Friedman, says that it should be blindingly obvious that this should be the moonshot of our generation. MIT's president, when she was inaugurated, said in an interesting way that I like, the time for progress is now. It is our responsibility to lead in this mission. And I've emphasized the word lead because normally the scientific enterprise is dictated by someone in Washington adding a zero to a budget and then we all go fishing for buildings and money. But as I'll show you, many reports, including several written by Rick Smalley and myself, and Rick spent the last 2 years of his life going around the country with people like me, saying that this was the problem, and also saying that there is no doubt that at our current levels that it will be too little, way too late. And so we have to lead in this mission if we're going to get it done. Energy is so big that we need its own units to describe it. And so I need to calibrate the scale of the problem. We're all familiar with a laptop. And actually, this should be about a PDA now, because laptops are a little more power hungry. A PDA is about a watt. 1,000 PDAs is a kilowatt, 1,000 watts, which is about the mean power load of your toaster. So don't leave your toaster on very long. That's equivalent to the average electricity load of your entire house, day-night averaged. 1,000 toasters is a small jet engine, a megawatt. 1,000 megawatts is a nuclear power plant's output of a gigawatt. And 1,000 nuclear power plants is equivalent to the world's electricity supply, a trillion watts or a terawatt. In this photo, which I have to explain to some audiences, but I'm sure not this one, wasn't all taken at the same time, because the Earth really isn't all dark at once. You can see the 2 billion people that in our planet still don't have electricity. You can see the difference between those that don't and those that do in North Korea and South Korea. You can see that if Rick Smalley used to say you take the top 10 problems and you try to enable solutions to them, including poverty, including disease, including wars, including many things, and there's only one solution that continually comes to the top to enable most of those top 10 things, and that is energy. Because without energy, you can't get food to people, you can't desalinate your water, you can't be in India with 2 candles at night and have your school children study to learn things in the daytime, you can't move up in society, you can't do much without energy. So it is the enabling underlying feature of most of the economies of the world, which is what makes this problem so big. To remind you, even that 1 trillion watts is only a fraction of the total energy that we use. It's not all electricity. In fact, only about 10% of what we use is electricity. And if you add it all up, you take all the energy in joules of thermal load consumed by humans on our planet in a year and divide by the number of seconds in a year, you get the average burn rate is about 13 trillion watts. So although politicians like to talk about how many cars will take off the road or light bulbs in Fresno will save, we need to be talking about 13 trillion watts because much less than that doesn't really matter on this problem. The United States uses a quarter of the world's energy. If you look in the National Energy Report, it's 96 quadrillion British thermal units in a year, but I guarantee you if you convert that to watts, it's 3.2 trillion watts. But I won't talk any more about the United States, because although it's very important in the national debate and in geopolitical concerns, for instance, it's clear that humans have always fought wars over natural resources, and there's no indication the future will be any different than the past. It's certainly true that there are some countries that have, say, oil resources that may not be our friends, but we actually know how we deal with that. We go to war, we take them over and make them our friends. And so we're going to get it all one way or another. The physics approach to the problem is to consider the spherical planet on which we live and the resources abundant there, and know that humans will eventually consume them unless stopped otherwise. Out of that 13 trillion watts, 85% is approximately consumed from fossil energy, with roughly equal parts oil, coal, and gas. A little bit, 2/10 out of the 13 is hydroelectric. Biomass, most people are surprised, is 10% of the total. It's 1 out of 13. But this is unsustainably burnt, deforesting crops and trees much faster than they can be replanted. The total amount of sustainable biomass is in the total renewables column, which all added up combined is only 0.2 terawatt. And then nuclear power right now is 0.9 terawatts. The astute amongst you will know that we only make 0.4 terawatts, 400 gigawatts of electricity, but this is the heat content produced by burning all the coal, of which only 1/3 of that energy goes into electricity, and the heat content produced by all the nuclear fission, of which only 1/3 goes into electricity on average out of a power plant. So on a fair footing, this is the heat content consumed of all the energy on our planet combined in an average representative year. Maybe we'll run out. In a longer version of this talk, I go into more detail here, but I will just give you the bottom line. If you take the proven reserves and divide by the 1998 as a representative year consumption rate, you see that we have between 40 years of proven reserves of conventional oil and 78 years if you include unconventional resources. Now the difference between a proven reserve, this is what the SEC lets you book and tell your stockholders you have in the ground with 90% confidence. We have between 60 and 160 years of proven reserves of natural gas and 220 years globally and also in the United States and China of coal. In addition, you should realize that we've had 40 years worth of proven reserves of oil since the day after oil was discovered. And it's been that way for the last 100 years. And you should not interpret this to mean that we will run out of oil in 40 years because discovery never stops. When it costs you $1 million a day to drill an oil well in the Gulf of Mexico, and when only one out of four wells that's drilled actually is wet, you invest as a company or a country enough money to prove out 40 years worth of proven reserves, and then you stop because you do something else with your money and return it to the stockholders. What matters more is the resource base, what the USGS estimates there is to be discovered. And there is between 50 and 150 years, depending on your range of oil, between 200 and 600 years of natural gas, and almost 2,000 years of coal. Furthermore, if we should actually peak or start to run out of oil, we already know how to convert gas or coal into liquids. Germany did that in World War II on a dime when denied oil by the Allies. They ran their country on coal. South Africa does it today. In fact, they convert coal to liquids at the single biggest point source of CO2 on our planet, visible from outer space. But they run their country off of this right now. ExxonMobil and Shell are spending $10 billion in Qatar to convert natural gas into liquid hydrocarbons. We can make our own, and in fact, estimates are that we could do that today in our country at $40 a barrel. And we don't do that because nobody believes with their money that they will make money at $40 a barrel for the next 40 years if they did that. And by the way, if we ran out of this, there are enough methane clathrates off the continental shelves that are estimated to be more there than all the oil, coal, and gas on our planet combined. So the Stone Age, let me go back, didn't end because we ran out of stones. Clue one. And the fossil energy age is simply not going to end anytime soon because we run out of cheap fossil energy. If we're worried about energy security, we have plenty of hydrocarbons that we can either fight over or convert ourselves, and we can let the market and the inventive companies bring it to us for some reasonable price. This is a rigorously established conclusion by the International Energy Agency, by our own EIA, and many other people that have looked at this problem in the global context. I have to change colors, though, because I just told you energy was a really important problem, and then I just told you there is nothing to worry about because we have so much of it, and it's so cheap that we don't really pay much attention to our electric bills because, after all, it's a really small fraction of most households' budgets. It's really pretty cheap. So now we have to understand the old saying of you have to be careful what you ask for because you might actually get it. We might use all of that fossil energy. I think Yogi Berra might have said this, but I think he didn't say a lot of the things people said he said. So I've traced it back to Shakespeare, at least. I know Leo Szilard, and several other people said it. No quotes. That won't stop me. I'm going to make a prediction anyway, but I'm going to borrow one from a paper by a now colleague of mine, Marty Hoffert, an important paper in Nature that was a summary of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's 1992 report. But this paper wasn't about climate. It was about energy, and that's why it's relevant to us. My favorite year is the last century, and here's the next half century to think about is 2050, because for two reasons. One, most people that I teach want to be in the world in 2050, so we want to think about that. Secondly, because energy is not like Google, when you can set up Google from nothing and in 2 years be a multi-trillion dollar industry. You have to make a lot of physical things to make a big difference in energy. A coal-fired power plant lasts for 40 years to return its investment. So does a nuclear power plant. So do all these big things we build. That means the energy infrastructure that is going to power our planet in 2050, we're building in the next 10 years. So 2050 isn't 40 years from now, it's basically now. Now, to understand what this scenario is like, we first have to understand human population, because humans consume energy. And the IPCC in this scenario said, well, we're at 6 billion now, and pick your favorite number by 2050, 9 or 10 billion, it doesn't matter, we'll call it 10 to be a round number, 10 billion people on our planet. Of course, people consume energy, but to figure out the total energy demand roughly as a guideline, we need to first understand economic growth, because after all, if we all just lived in caves and didn't go anywhere, we wouldn't have to consume much energy. So we have to understand that energy is the engine behind economic growth. And so per capita GDP growth globally has averaged about 1.6% per year, historically. And in this so-called business as usual scenario, the IPCC said, what I believe is now a very conservative estimate, that we believe that global economic growth could be held at the historical average of 1.6% a year. Now, they didn't foresee at the time the double-digit sustained growth of India and China. The developed countries believe 3 or 4% economic growth is sustainable. No country has a policy against economic growth. So we hope this number doesn't turn negative, but whether it's 1 or 2 or 3% is absolutely irrelevant to the problem. So we'll pick the historical number. These two things, unmitigated, through the magic of compound interest of exponential growth, would lead to a tripling of energy demand by 2050. So instead of 13 trillion watts, we would need 45 trillion watts. On the other hand, we are saving energy per unit of productivity as a globe. And in fact, we're saving energy at a rate of about 1% per year in this so-called energy intensity. Now, the IPCC projected that we would continue along that historical trend in this business as usual. The United States is actually saving energy at twice the global average. We're at 2% a year, but we can only do that because we are so wasteful off of a high base that it's much easier for us to save than when you only have two candles at night. How much energy can you actually save? Right? And so the global average is about half of the United States. But we'll just assume this, and whether it's 1 or 2% doesn't matter. Because actually, everything we know about or could envision is built into sustaining this particular energy efficiency rate. We're going to assume that every new car is a 100-mile-a-gallon car from today forward, that every new house is a zero-energy home, that every step is taken for energy efficiency at everywhere in the supply chain under this prediction, because this level predicts that the average energy consumption per person on our planet in 45 years is at 2 kilowatts per person. These are the historical data for the United States. We currently consume 10 kilowatts per person. Here's Europe, here's Japan, the most energy efficient developed country in the world. China's above this line now, but we're going to assume we save so much energy that everybody is equivalent on average to 5 times less energy consumption than we currently use in our country today. Right? That's a tough order. To give you a feeling for what this is, if you're on a 2,000 calorie a day diet, then that's 100 watts. So humans are 100 watt light bulbs. That sounds pretty good because I budgeted 2 kilowatts, except that that food had to come from somewhere. The energy needed to grow the food, the energy needed to transport that food, to refrigerate it, to process it, to get it into your home, is between 10 and 20 times the energy in the food. That means that just to eat, you need to budget 1 kilowatt, and we will only budget 2. So if we save enough energy down to twice the level it takes to eat for every single person on our planet within 50 years, starting today, that will lead us to the prediction that multiplying those three curves, we could hold energy demand to double what it is now. And even if we did better than that, nothing I'll tell you about will actually change. We can get all this energy from burning coal. In fact, China is building the equivalent of 2 gigawatts of electric-fired coal generation a week. That's the equivalent of 2 nuclear power plants a week they built just last year for the entire year. The world is completely recarbonizing its energy mix back toward coal now as being abundant and inexpensive. So we need to figure in this third factor. The third factor is, in order to produce all that energy, what would be the consequences? This tells us the ratio of carbon emitted to the atmosphere as CO2 per unit of energy consumed historically over our planet. And you can see we've declined. And we did this because we started out with wood burning in caves to heat us, and that's just bad engineering because most of the energy goes out into the atmosphere and hardly any gets to the person in the cave. And then in the 19th century, we did better. We started to power our locomotives with coal. Coal is essentially all carbon, so when you burn it, you get all carbon dioxide per unit of energy produced. And then we're doing better. Natural gas is CH4, so when you burn it, you make one molecule of CO2 and 2 molecules of water. So more of the energy is produced from the water that's formed relative to the carbon as CO2 formed. And that gives us this ratio. And oil, being CH2 in its formula, is in between coal and gas. These three numbers we can do nothing about because they are fundamental properties of the heats of combustion and chemical formulas of oil, coal, and gas. And the energy mix on average, being roughly equal parts oil, coal, and gas, led us to here in 1990. In addition to holding demand down to twice the level it takes to eat, the IPCC said under this business as usual scenario that we believe that we will continue to decarbonize the energy mix for the next 50 years in accord with the historical trend. That means that by 2050, the average carbon intensity is lower than that of a pure natural gas economy. The only way you can do that, get the average below the values of any of the individual numbers, is to have a zero somewhere in the equation in order to bring the average lower. Furthermore, to the extent that we don't just burn natural gas in 50 years, and that we burn roughly equal parts of oil, coal, and gas, you need even more zero to get the average down to there. I'll tell you how much you need, but I'll assume for now that we do this too. So in addition to saving energy down to twice the level it takes to eat, starting today, and to decarbonizing the energy mix down to better than a pure natural gas economy, now we can use this as a guideline to see if we know the amount of energy consumed and the amount of carbon emitted per energy demanded, how much carbon under this scenario will appear into our atmosphere. There is nothing but arithmetic here. There are no assumptions involved. The significance of that brings us on to this top curve. And what you have to understand is that these other curves are the curves that would be needed if you wanted to hold the atmospheric carbon dioxide levels at the numbers in parts per million indicated on the curves. For instance, if you wanted to hold the atmospheric CO2 levels to 350 parts per million, the pre-anthropogenic level was 280, you would have to emit no carbon ever again on our planet within our lifetimes. None. If you wanted to hold it to 450 or even double, you still need to do better than that scenario that I just showed you, because that produced the top curve. Now, we do not know, outside of a climate model, which levels are or are not safe. We do not even know how to define what the word safe is. What we do know is we do know that CO2 levels have been in a narrow band from ice core data for the last 400,000 years, now extended to 750,000 years, 670,000 to be precise. And they have ranged between 200 and 300 parts per million. And swings of 100 parts per million have been highly correlated with, repeatedly, but not proven to be the causes of temperature swings that have repeatedly sent us into ice ages. We know that within our lifetimes, under even that scenario, that the CO2 levels will be twice as high or more as any human would have otherwise experienced, and they are already higher than what we believe has been on our planet in the last 20 million years. We do not know which level is safe. There are 6 major climate models. They all differ from each other. That means that as scientists, we know that at least 5 of them must be wrong. We just don't know which they are. Furthermore, we don't have enough initial conditions. We don't know what all the clouds were 50 years ago, or even 20 years ago, and all the temperatures of the oceans and all of the sea core data and so on, to even calibrate or initialize the models properly. And so they take averages of many conditions when they represent their output. But the Earth is not on an average path. The Earth is on one path, and nobody knows which one. This is absolutely not about sound science. Because if you wait for a climate model to predict what the climate will be like in 2050, then I will tell you what the only rigorous prediction a scientist can make about when we'll be able to do that. And that's when we open our door on January 1st, 2050, and look outside. This is all about risk management. It is not about science. We do know what we see. This is 10 years worth of Greenland sea ice melting in the summer. We do know that 20% of the coral is already bleached, and many, but not all, climate models predict that due to the acidification of the oceans by CO2, that between half and all of it will be bleached within our lifetime as we lower the pH to a level that it has not been before in at least 100 million years on our planet. No climate model has in it nonlinear feedbacks. Here's an example of this nonlinear feedback. This used to be all frozen permafrost and reflective ice. Helium bubbles that tell us when this has been released show us that it is melting now where it hasn't melted in at least 40,000 years. The significance of that is that as this ice melts, it reflects less, and then it melts more permafrost. There's enough carbon dioxide and methane trapped in the permafrost that if it is released, levels won't go up by a factor of 2, they could go up by a factor of 10. This did happen once before on our planet. It happened 230 million years ago in the Permian era, when there was an isotopically light, rapid release of carbon dioxide. The levels went up by a factor of 10. Temperatures did spike by 5 or 6 degrees. And the fossil record shows that 90% of the species that were then on Earth went extinct. We absolutely do not know this would happen again. We absolutely do know there is only one way to find out. I have to decode that second number, which I hope you have all remembered. Because CO2 is not like ozone, which is a reactive chemical species that is formed and destroyed. And so we could emit other chemicals that didn't harm the ozone layer and have it rapidly go away on a timescale of 50 years. CO2 is the most oxidized form of our carbon dioxide in our oxidizing atmosphere. We get it as the final thermodynamic product from burning fossil fuels. There are no natural destruction mechanisms of carbon dioxide. And that means it has to be physically removed from the atmosphere into the oceans. It equilibrates with the near-surface oceans quickly, and the rest of it has to be transported by mixing from the near-surface oceans to the deep oceans. There are 2 time constants for that process, best knowledge says. 3/4 of it would go away in 500 years. The other quarter would take roughly 5,000 years. And a good average number would be that what we do in the next 50 years is going to last for a time scale of 3,000 years, comparable to modern human history. And nobody has a technically credible way of getting rid of the 600 trillion pounds of CO2 that will be in our atmosphere by then. This is absolutely not about predicting what the climate will be like. This is absolutely about, and I haven't told you what the answer is, but I've told you that there is a risk management issue here that we need to decide whether we want to bear or not. In that scenario that I showed you, which didn't stabilize carbon dioxide levels within our lifetime, even at twice where they were before any human had interrupted it, you need 10 terawatts. If you want to stabilize carbon dioxide and hold its concentration level at twice, 550 parts per million, you need more than that. If you want to do better than that, you need more than that. By any measure, you need as much carbon-free power brought online within our lifetimes as all the oil, coal, gas, and nuclear power we consume on our planet today combined. Nothing else is serious. If you build a few nuclear power plants, it does nothing to solve this problem. And remember, because it lasts so long, if you wait 45 years to start, you've got 45 years more worth of emissions under your belt that simply don't go away. This is why Marty Hoffert said, these results underscore the pitfalls of wait and see, because in this problem, wait and see is wait and do. On the other hand, where in the world could we get 10 or 15 or 20 trillion watts of carbon-free power on our planet? I haven't said we have to do this. I have said that there is a plausible scenario under which there is a risk in doing it, in the same way that there is a plausible scenario that we might choose individually to buy hurricane insurance before the hurricane hits or not. We won't be able to predict whether or not our house is going to be in the path of that hurricane before we get to decide if we want to buy insurance. On the other hand, it's not easy. There are three general classes of technologies that now I'm back in the present as opposed to the future that you could consider if you decide you want to hold carbon dioxide emissions at any reasonable level, which is not a decision we've made as a society. The only proven technology we have to do that is nuclear power. Nothing else we have that is proven can scale. I'm not personally for or against nuclear power, but I do believe that people should understand what they are voting for, because if we vote not to do anything else, then this is the only thing that we will have on our table. Now, I've already told you the issues. The issues are, if you remember that first scale slide, a nuclear power plant built at about the level at which we can safely build them to hold the radiation and heat fluxes produces a billion watts, a gigawatt. Even at the level of energy demand reduced to twice the level it takes to eat, to hold CO2 to double, you need 10 or 15 terawatts. That means you need, at 10,000 new nuclear reactors. That means you need to build one every other day continuously somewhere in the world for the next 50 straight years. Okay. It turns out, by the way, at $3 a watt, this is a capital investment of $30 trillion. World GDP is only $60 trillion. It turns out there's not enough uranium to do this when once through cycles, the way we do it now, for more than 10 years of operation at this level. In all the terrestrial resources on our planet, you could get out of seawater, but you would need the equivalent, because it's very dilute, of 3,000 Niagara Falls is running all the time in the oceans of the world to mine that amount of water to get the needed uranium. And so if you actually ask people of what this level of nuclear power, or even if you want to build one a week, and by the way, we've only built 430 nuclear power plants in human history, and I've been giving this talk for 5 years, and we should have already built several thousand, so we're well behind this pace. You have to close the fuel cycle, and right now, of course, the only proven way to do that involves plutonium. We would need 10 or 15,000 such plutonium-based nuclear reactors starting today. Now, we should credit North Korea and Iran for stepping up to do their part to mitigate global warming, right? if you only build one a week, you leave 95% of this problem on the table. So we have to turn to some other cards that we might want to play in combination. The second way is to burn fossil energy, but don't let the CO2 go into the atmosphere. That's called carbon capture and storage or sequestration. It's our nation's number one energy policy. It involves taking a coal-fired power plant and taking the output stream of carbon dioxide in a concentrated form of which no current plant produces, but the hope is that we will finally build one called Future Gen sometime. And of course, the big problem with the Future Gen plant is the word future in its name. And then we will put that CO2 somewhere. Of course, we emit billions of metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. In fact, 6 billion tons a year just in the United States. We have to put it all somewhere. The ocean has a large enough volume, but it's going to change the pH of the ocean. It's been largely now technically discredited. You could put it in the underground oil and gas reservoirs, where, after all, natural gas has been stored for geologic time. But there's only 30 years worth of global capacity at global emissions rates to do that. The oil companies are now exploring doing this. They do put CO2 in the ground for enhanced oil recovery. That makes more CO2 from the oil they produce than the CO2 they bury. So you should not confuse that with sequestration. The only place where there's big enough capacity is in the underground aquifers, in the underground brines, where it's estimated there is between 50 and 150 years. That's a wide range, but that's the best estimates now of global capacity to put all of that carbon. Here's a map of where the sequestration potential sites are and where the power plants are. And you could see kind of one-third of them are okay. Although there's a match there, you need to understand that there's over 1.5 million holes from wildcat drilling operations in Texas. That's a hard set of dikes to plug up with thumbs, because you should not assume that, despite the fact that it's our number one energy policy, that this works technically. We know that CO2 migrates underground. In Lake Nyos, Cameroon in 1985, it came up and killed almost 1,700 people. We know it will move in the aquifers. We don't know how far. If you're doing this for 100 years, and after that point it leaks at 1% a year for 100 years, then the flux coming back up is identical to what you tried to mitigate in the first place. Because it lasts so long in the air, that means the lifetime underground has to be on the order of 500 to 1,000 years, and therefore the leak rate globally averaged has to be 0.1% a year for on the order of a millennium. And we have to know that now, because that's where we need to put it at this scale. And finally, of course, every aquifer is geologically different. So even if it could be proven within 10 years of data that it would work with a 99% confidence for a millennium at one site, then you have to do it all over again at every of the other thousands of sites that you would need to write the environmental impact report on. We should, in my opinion, be doing everything we can to try to see if we can technically play this card, because it becomes very difficult to think about all the coal-fired power plants in the United States and China being shut down because we had nowhere safely to put their carbon dioxide. On the other hand, it is not at all technically clear that we could say that we can do that within the next 10 years. By the way, the DOE's goal is that they hope to sequester 4 total gigatons of CO2 this way by 2050. That's their goal. We emit, in terms of carbon, 1.5 gigatons a year right now. And they want to a cumulative total of 4 gigatons within 45 years. So again, that's nothing compared to the total emissions. And then this brings us to renewables, because if you can't burn all that carbon, you have to get your energy from a non-carbon containing or carbon neutral source. In the longer version of this talk, which you can find on the web, you can see all the details of the numbers I'm going to tell you about here that are all peer reviewed, and they all come from consensus numbers, so I didn't make them up in any way. Of course, we have 6: hydroelectricity, geothermal, wind, biomass, and solar. Commonly cited renewables, and tides are also in here. Hydroelectricity is a model renewable energy resource. It's pretty cheap. It's true that when you build a dam in China, only 1 million people get displaced, but all energy sources have their issues. The big issue with hydroelectricity is pretty simple. If you look at the potential energy contained, converted into kinetic energy, and all the water flow on our planet combined, it's only worth 4.5 terawatts. Furthermore, you can't dam up the Okefenokee Swamp and get much energy out of it. You need a head space height to do it. And so where it's technically feasible, you can only get 1.5 terawatts. It's technically in principle feasible to dam up the Hudson River, but the Yankees would have to find a new place to play in addition to a new manager. Where it's economically feasible is estimated to only be 0.9 terawatts, and we already have an installed capacity of 0.6 because it's pretty cheap, so we've done it everywhere we can do it, so there's no room to grow. Geothermal energy, there's a lot of heat trapped in the ground, but there are a lot of trees that we could cut down faster than they would regrow again, too. And what's more relevant here is the sustainable heat flux that's due to us having a warm core of the Earth of our planet and a cool outer surface. We know the temperature of the surface of the Earth. We know the estimated temperature of the core. We know its thermal conductivity. You can look up in any geophysics textbook in chapter 1 what the average geothermal flux is from the core to the surface of our planet. And over land, that number is 57 milliwatts per square meter. That's the sustainable amount of geothermal energy that natural forces give to us from the center to the surface. If you multiply that number by all land on Earth, and you take 100% efficient heat engines, which a French sergeant, Carnot, had a word or two to say about, but we'll assume he didn't exist for a while, and 100% efficiency, if you covered all the land on Earth with 100% efficient heat engines, you'd only get 11 terawatts. So the heat of the Earth isn't close to satisfying our thirst for carbon-free power. If you take all the wind resources on our planet combined and add them all up in all the high wind speed areas, you might get 2 to 3 terawatts total. Here's a 20 terawatt line. Here's the energy potential of all the ocean currents on a logarithmic scale. All the tides and all the waves on our planet combined are not close. You could make a lot of money being a Google-like company at 1/100th of the scale of energy because it's a multi-trillion dollar a year business. But you can't make a lot of energy even while you're making a lot of money. We hear a lot about biomass. But plants are fundamentally inefficient. They are green, not black. They have the wrong band gap to be an energy conversion machine to match the solar spectrum. Furthermore, in addition to that, it's not well known, but it is well known to the biochemists that study plant photosynthesis, that the Rubisco enzyme that is used is a very low turnover enzyme. And because of that, nature has built in a system to meter out its electrons so that photosynthesis saturates in productivity at 1/10 of the intensity of the sun. So the plants will be productive under the shade of the canopy, but not be damaged by the high radical high light intensity in the bright sunlight. Because of that, the fastest growing plants only store in all the cellulose and lignin and all the biomass together only 0.5 or 0.3% of the total sunlight that hits it over an average year. Okay. The best way to see this is if you take all the land where you could grow crops on our planet, subtract off all we currently grow crops, and take half again as much to feed twice as many people, and take all the rest and plant it all with the fastest known grown energy crop, and assume no energy into the farm, and assume no energy needed to farm it or convert it to something else, take it all, you might get 5 terawatts if you did it everywhere on our planet. To give you a feeling, this number is updated. Last year, 20% of the U.S. corn provided 2% of our transportation fuel, and it used almost as much energy in the form of coal as we got out of it in the form of ethanol. In addition, we now have a law going through Congress that will increase this number by a factor of 5. quick arithmetic says that if 20% required 2%, that would be all of our corn to offset 10% of our transportation fuel. This is why, at minimum, we have to find a way to convert cellulose more efficiently into something that we humans can use, which most technical people think is not ethanol, because you can't pipe it, because it's corrosive, and because it only has 2/3 of the energy density of gasoline. But even if you did, studies have shown that you might at best, if you took the billion tons of cellulosic material now not used in the United States for food, make enough ethanol to offset 30% of our transportation fuels, which is 25% of our total energy. So you could offset, if you did it everywhere, 8% of our energy, and no more. There's one big number. Plants are material. They can offset an important component of 30% of liquid transportation fuels. But if you're looking to stabilize CO2 concentrations, you can't just look there. Even though they're inefficient, plants utilize the big resource. The solar constant is worth 120,000 terawatts, and we need 10. The other way to say that is that more energy from the sun hits the Earth in 1 hour than all the energy consumed on our planet in an entire year. No other energy source even comes close. I promised you Willie Sutton. Willie Sutton was the bank robber who robbed a whole lot of banks before they caught him. And finally, when they caught him, they asked him, "Why do you rob banks, Mr. Sutton?" He said, "Because that's where the money is." Now, if Willie Sutton were here, he would say, you know, that's where the energy is. So even if we get a tiny fraction of it, we'd have more energy than humans could ever dream of using. Photosynthesis right now supports life on Earth with 90 terawatts. But we can't have any of that because it's in detailed balance with respiration, with providing the oxygen that we use to breathe. Here's a map. If you had a 10% efficient farm of some kind, of how much land you would have to cover to provide not all the electricity, but all the energy of our country forever. It's 1.6% of our land. It's not a small area. It's 10 times bigger than everybody's roof. It's comparable to the nation's numbered highway system. The good news is, I've been giving this talk for 5 years, and I've never met anybody that actually lives there. So I don't think we would miss it. Anybody here? I'm safe. You would never do it this way, of course. You would distribute it. And I haven't told you what it is. Right? But it gives you a feeling of the scale of the problem. Here's 6 3-terawatt boxes. You don't have to put them in the deserts. That was representative mid-latitudes. It's 0.16% of the Earth's surface, but it's not a small land area compared to what we're thinking about usually of going to concentrated energy sources and just digging up a lump of coal out of the ground and saying thank you very much and burning it. The reason solar is so expensive is because it does require lots of land compared to conventional energy sources. In fact, if you have a 15 or 10% efficient solar cell and the intensity of the sun doesn't change over 50 years, then I've told you how much product I'm going to make and sell to you over 30 years. And now, if it costs me $300 a square meter to put that stuff up on my roof, I have to make sure that I sell you the electricity at such a price that I can recover what I paid for it over the 30 years that stuff's going to last me. And if I don't want to make money, just don't want to lose money, if it costs me $300 a square meter to make the stuff, and another $300 to put it up on the roof, which is the case in California when the person has to come and install it now and hook it up to the grid, then I have to sell it to you at 25 cents a kilowatt hour in order to just break even. Utility scale electricity costs 5 cents a kilowatt hour right now, including storage. So this isn't a fair fight. You can see that you just can't get there by improving the efficiency. You have to lower the cost. In fact, you have to lower the cost to something in the range of $10 or $20 a square meter. to give you a feeling for what that is, the cost of paint at Home Depot is $1 a square meter. The cost of this carpet is $10 a square meter. You have to get something that's about the cost of painting your roof or rolling out carpet in order to really make it cost effective compared to what we now pay for energy. There are ways you could think about doing that. You could take small particles that are really impure material and not very costly and link them together and fool them in such a way to think they're a single crystal and very expensive in what we lovingly call solar paint. We have such formulations actually in a few labs around our country. Either the ones that work really well don't last long enough yet, or the ones that last long enough don't work really well yet, but there's no law of physics that says we can't do this. We haven't done it yet. Even, however, if we make solar cells that are free, you should not be deceived into thinking that we would solve this problem. And that's because the sun figured it out a long time ago with nature. Plants are valuable because, Johnny Cochran would have said, he that cannot store shall not have energy after four, right? And if solar cells are free, all they will do is make energy between 10 and 4 on a sunny California day, and we need it all the time. And there is no good way to store massive quantities of electricity. If there is, you should all go buy it at a nickel a kilowatt hour at night and sell it to all your friends at 25 cents a kilowatt hour every daytime and go laugh all the way to the bank. There's no proven way. The cheapest way is pumping water uphill. You can do that every winter to fill a reservoir and empty it every summer, but imagine all the water you would need filling every day and emptying every night to buffer the United States' electricity supply. I can tell you it's something like 3,000 Lake Meads. To give you a feeling for this, the energy contained in 1 gallon of gasoline would require 55,000 gallons of water pumped up the height of Hoover Dam, because you're trading a chemical bond energy for an MGH potential energy, and that's a really bad trade. Solar cells make the wrong product. They make electricity, which there is no good way to store. Plants figured it out. They make chemical fuel, which after all runs 90% of our economy because it stores and dispatches energy efficiently compared to any other way we know how to do it. So we have to figure out how to cover less area and make a product that we really can use, chemical fuel, directly from the sun, without having the inefficiency that photosynthesis does. Oh, by the way, photosynthesis, the reaction center, only lasts 30 minutes in the sun because it undergoes radical damage, and nature spends a lot of the energy in the plant just to remake the plant every 30 minutes to keep it running. You'll see this on the DOE website, where you'll take biofuels and convert it into a box that's going to make hydrogen. You would never do this, because if you had enough biofuels, you would just refine it and make biodiesel and run your cars and burn it in a carbon neutral cycle and declare victory. If you ever had electricity, you would use it at the point of production for high value energy that it is. What we are missing is a way to really cheaply capture, convert, and store directly the energy from the sun, which is our biggest resource that we have. To give you a feeling for how far away we are, here's how we would have to do that today. We would have to take this dual-axis tracker, or the kind of Star Wars thing, and it would track the sun and focus its rays onto this machine, which is either an external combustion Stirling engine or a high-efficiency concentrator photovoltaic cell. And then it would put its electricity into this box, which contains probably half the world's supply of platinum. And every day, this plus this thing would fill up that tank with hydrogen. Right? And by the way, you have to build one of these a second for the next 50 straight years if you want to hold CO2 to double. This is simply not a scalable technology, period. We have to think about ways to make it like a leaf, because photosynthesis figured this out. It takes charge and separates it across a membrane and never makes electricity. It directly makes chemical fuel. This process is the inverse of a fuel cell, where in comes fuel and out comes electricity. Instead, in comes energy and out comes fuel. We know, nature knows how to do this. We know this bug has a hydrogenase in it. that doesn't use an expensive metal like platinum, it uses a cheap metal, iron. It's not poisoned by carbon monoxide and sulfur, it actually has them in the molecule. So nature figured out how to make lemonade out of lemons. We now only recently know the structure of this enzyme, and chemists are starting to pull this reactive site out and trying to make mimics of these hydrogenases to do in the lab, and hopefully in the field someday, what nature figured out a long time ago. We now only recently know the structure of the manganese center with some resolution that oxidizes water to oxygen. If you don't oxidize water to oxygen, you can't make any kind of fuel, because you have to be able to vent your oxygen to the air somewhere and pick it up somewhere else, or you don't, by definition, have a chemical fuel. So we have to figure out how to do that too. So in the end, we're going to need more energy because we have a lot of people to bring out of poverty still, and there's no law that says that they don't deserve that. Even if we hold energy constant, which our planet has never done in any year, used less energy in mankind than it used in the year before, if we held it constant for the next 50 years, you would just take a triangularly increasing ramp and leave a constant value. But remember, CO2 levels don't go away. That means the time that it would take to get to doubling is just put off by 15 years. You can't conserve your way out of this problem. That means the case for significant or daunting amounts of carbon-free power is either plausible or imperative, depending on your risk profile. Any energy policy could not start without energy efficiency. It's cheaper to save a joule of energy than it is to make it, and saving one at the home saves making five upstream. I assume that we save energy down to twice the level it takes to eat. If we don't do that, you have to make even more carbon-free power in order to hold CO2 levels to double, because the planet does its arithmetic all the time, even if we don't want to balance the books. So you have to start there, but no amount of energy saving ever turned on a light bulb. No amount of energy saving actually put food on somebody's table. You still have to make a massive amount of carbon-free power within our lifetimes if this is something that you don't want to see happen. There are only three big cards that we have. There's coal, if we can prove that sequestration works or dare to do it anyway. There's nuclear power with plutonium, if we double there. And then let's find a cheap way to make stored energy as fuel from the sun that we don't really yet have. These have to be really cheap, because we have to be able to get people in China and India to afford it as well as the developed countries, or you don't get anywhere. I haven't talked much about policy. I've talked only about science and technical numbers that are beyond dispute, and I won't take a policy position. There are two opposing views on this issue. One is that this is something we simply can't afford to do. It will cost money. Switching any mature technology developed over a century will cost money, there is no doubt. The diametrically opposed view is this is something at which we simply cannot afford to fail. Because, unfortunately, CO2 lasts so long that we get exactly one chance to fix the problem. On the other hand, as I said earlier, we spend more money buying gas at the pump in 1 hour than we spend on all solar energy research, for instance, in our country in an entire year. We are not close to thinking seriously about remaking a multi-trillion dollar industry within the next 10 years, which is what you are talking about doing if you are serious about talking about fixing this problem. So the question, which is above my pay grade for sure, is whether we want to be serious about fixing this problem or not. I think we could do it. This isn't like building a bomb and we didn't know the principles. You know, we know how to build nuclear power plants. We could build more of them if we wanted to, if we had enough money and resources to do it. We know in principle how to make photosynthesis work better. We know how to make solar cells with a 30-year warranty. I think we could develop a technology set that would do this if we were serious about doing it, and we could do it pretty fast. But we would have to really change our mentality about deciding that this is something that we can't afford to fail, as opposed to having something that just might be nice to succeed. The way I like to summarize this is, you know, if we don't build the next nano widget in the next 20 years, the world may not be better, but it's going to be the same. Mm-hmm. If we don't cure cancer, and I lost my dad to it, and my wife lost both her parents to it, so we know, you know, that's a tragic disease. But if we don't cure cancer in 20 years, the world's going to be the same. May not be better, but it's going to be the same. We know, like it or not, because CO2 lasts so long, that if we don't fix this problem in the next 20 years, that for a timescale comparable to modern human history, the world is not going to be the same. We don't know how different that world will be. We just know that we're going to do the biggest experiment with our planet that humans have ever done. So that's why I could defend the idea that energy is the most important problem facing science and technology in the next 50 years. So with that, thanks so much for listening, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Fabulous. Question. So wait for the mic so everybody can hear the question. So there'll be two of us running around with mics, I believe.
I've always wondered what the CO2 burden for manufacturing single crystal solar cells is.
Right. Okay. So the question is, currently, what's the energy return compared to the energy invested for crystalline solar cells, which have 90% of the market? Using current manufacturing techniques, they pay themselves back on an energy basis, the good news is, in 3.8 years. And they're warrantied for 30 years. So there's no doubt that they make 10 times more energy back over their lifetime than is used to make them in the first place. That's the good news. Here is the bad news. Right now, solar cells produce one part in 10 to the fourth of our total energy supply. If they continue to grow at 30% a year, 35% a year annual growth rate, which they are now doing, they would have to do that for 40 straight years at 30% growth rate in order to be kind of 10% of our total energy. If something takes 3.8 years to pay back its energy and it's growing at 30% a year, then you have to use all the energy of the current installed base to support the next year's growth every year for the next 40 years. So you wouldn't make any net energy at all over the next 40 years, because if 100% recycled, you'd consume it all just to make all those solar cells that would be needed. So there's both sides to that coin.
I was wondering if you would comment on the two things that you didn't mention, one being very simple and the other one being hard. The first one is population reduction.
Ah.
And the second one, the
hard. Is that the simple or the hard one?
That's the hard.
Thank you.
The simpler one is fusion.
Fusion. Let's do fusion first.
Chicken.
That's a one-word question. Here's a one-word answer. Time. If you look at ITER, an important $10 billion project, in my opinion, as designed, it's supposed to demonstrate technical break-even 35 years from now. Now, of course, all fusion projects have always been designed to break even 35 years from now, but we'll assume we're right this time. That whole system, if it runs at break-even, is designed to run for 1 week before it will disintegrate. under the radiation and neutron fluxes and temperatures of ITER. If in 35 years it works for a week, remember CO2 emissions are cumulative, and you need the equivalent of 10,000 of them built starting now, we simply don't have enough time. Now let's talk about population, which does always come up. Of course, a mathematically allowed solution to the problem, mathematically allowed, is to go from 6 billion people down to 2 billion people. That would stretch this out for, 100, 150 years, right? So I believe in democracy, and therefore everybody should get to vote. Remember that we consume, as the United States citizens, 5 times as much energy as people in Africa, and 3 times as much or twice as much as people in China. So let's get everybody vote on who has to go in order to cut down carbon emissions. You'll see how that vote would turn out. All right? So it's a big problem. And there's another issue. The other related serious issue is that China and India especially have taken the potentially, I'm not going to get into politics, defensible potentially position that since emissions are cumulative, their citizens should be able to catch up to the cumulative emissions of the United States. If you, of course, take that position, 550 will be in our rearview mirrors faster than we know about. To give you a feeling for how that scenario compares to what we've done, that scenario, business as usual, was developed in 1992. In the 1990s, we actually pretty much followed it, and emissions only increased at 1.1% per year. And then at 2000, with all the talk of Kyoto, we all collectively tightened our belts and showed the world what we could do. And in the last 6 years, we tripled it. And we're now emitting at an increased rate of 3.1% per year, higher than the most pessimistic scenario. And I showed you an arguably optimistic scenario for emissions. So we would have to do even better. No region of the world is now decarbonizing its energy intensity like that assumption was. Everybody is flat or going up as we consume more coal. No region of the world is following that energy intensity decline continuously. It was followed as a planet because we had the breakup of the former Soviet Union, which depressed their economy and kept us on that line for a while, and we've turned up from that too. So the track record over the past 15 years has borne out the inference that the business as usual scenario is hardly business as usual.
Does your emphasis on nuclear energy include the carbon fuels used to mine the uranium, to process it into usable form, to transport it long distances, and it being a very heavy metal?
Okay. So I didn't personally clarify my position. I didn't emphasize yes or no for any of those options. I just told you what would be involved if you wanted to deploy them in part or in whole at a material level to contribute to this solution. The energy return on energy invested for mining the ore and building the plant of a modern day fission plant is controversial, but recent relatively reliable estimates claim that it's about a year and a half of the output of a plant. So like the solar cells returning about 3.8 years of their energy input for the 30 years, reasonable estimates show that about less than a year, maybe 0.9 of a year, but something like a year, all the energy needed to use to build that plant and its mine the ores, at least from where we get them now, can be recovered, and they run for 40 years. But the issue was that there isn't enough uranium to do it that way at this scale.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, and if you did, I may have missed it, but what about hydrogen fuel cells?
Ah.
And also one other thing.
I was deliberately vague on the fuel. Let me take a pointed position. Right now, there are only four things you need to do to use hydrogen in transportation. You need to cheaply make it, you need to distribute it, you need to store it, and you need to use it on board a car. We can't do any of those things cost effectively. The amount of platinum in a fuel cell powered school bus now costs $500,000, which means we will have a vigorous hydrogen economy consisting of stolen school buses, right? Okay? Hydrogen, on the other hand, is potentially a perfectly good chemical fuel storage medium if used like natural gas for stationary sites, where you would just pump it on demand and not have to worry about storing it, just like you use for heating your house right now with natural gas, to heat to either in fuel cells or just burning it to make the low value energy that we use to both run our factories and run our vehicles and make our electricity from. So the rational path, in fact, the path that we take, is to take the liquid substrate, water, that's concentrated, and take sunlight and try to split that into hydrogen and oxygen. It's not clear you'd want that hydrogen as a fuel for transportation, but we already know how to convert that with CO2 to a liquid fuel, methanol. That's an industrial process over zinc oxide. And we already know how to take methanol and convert it with one loss of water, with no energy lost basically, into DME, dimethyl ether, a nearly perfect diesel fuel and already a good clean cooking fuel in China. So the choice of the end fuel is actually the cart before the horse here. The real issue is, how do you cost effectively make any fuel to begin with no carbon emitted from the sun? And then we can figure out the rest as we progress along the technology chain. If you wait for transportation to become cost effective, you're asking four things to happen at once and you'll be waiting a long time.
Is there something else we could burn besides carbon that would offset the climate change, carbon dioxide?
He asked if there's something else we could burn besides carbon that would offset the carbon dioxide. I interpret that as two different questions. One is there another fuel we could use? And that's just hydrogen instead of fixing carbon from water. There's only two loops you could make. But the other thing is there some other thing we could do that could react with CO2 in our atmosphere and get rid of it?
Well, it's more of an emergency backup.
All right.
Put something in the atmosphere to offset.
Right, okay. So this falls under the general concept of geoengineering, right? So there are now semi-serious discussions about geoengineering, including things like launching space parasols to block a portion of the sunlight to compensate for the radiative forcing that we would have been increased, to add aerosols to the stratosphere where they'll last for 2 or 3 years. We'll have gray skies, but we'll have less sunlight come in. And then this is a new one that I've heard of, trying to actually chemically inject something to react with CO2. I personally think that's even dicier, to throw billions of tons of something up there a year and, you know, hope it doesn't hurt anything else. So let me talk about the other two, because I think they're huge problems. So the fact that I put this lower, you know, we obviously don't understand the predictive way of our climate system, right? It's a highly nonlinear system, highly coupled over many feedbacks. And to think that in an open loop sense that we could launch one thing and exert open loop control over that and retune our climate back to where it was is hardly something I would feel comfortable that we could say we could do. How would you know you had it right? You know, if the United States decided that it wanted to tune back its climate, but it screwed up Africa for 10 years, could they shoot it down? Who gets to decide what to do? And besides, all these radiative transfer things neglect the fact that CO2 is also an acid and it's changing the pH of our oceans and affecting the ecosystems. So even if you could fix the radiative balance, you still have the chemical effects to deal with, which nobody yet knows how to undo. So why would you try to voluntarily subject yourself to an experimental chemotherapy if you had a vaccine that you could take for the disease, right? we still have a vaccine we could take in principle to prevent getting the disease, so we don't have to worry about doing the second experiment.
So I'd like to ask a provocative question. So in the KITP brochure here, there's a blurb that says that we're fostering collaborative research by the world's leading scientists on the most challenging and timely questions of our time. And we've got cosmology and string theory and consciousness and things like that. So my question is, should we drop all of this and focus on energy?
Absolutely. You want me to answer let me answer it in a different way. Of course not. But okay, here's a plan. You have a multi-$1 trillion business, right? If you look at the pharmaceutical companies that have to reinvent themselves or die to invent the next generation of drugs, if you look at the semiconductor industry, it has to make smaller, better, faster, cheaper chips every several years or the competition wipes them out. They invest something like 10% of revenue on R&D to run faster, die, right? If you ask Jeff Immelt, CEO of General Electric, what's happened in his tenure, he'll tell you he's overseen five generations of healthcare technology and the same one of energy as he started from. And that's because we don't invest anything in R&D. The energy oil companies invest less than pulp and paper companies as a percentage of revenue on R&D. The electric utility industry, as a percentage of revenue, spends less on R&D than the dog food industry does. So if you think about putting your money where your mouths are, you know, we're going to the dogs, right? You would really need to make an energy effort comparable to what we spend on health at the NIH. And if you had $30 billion a year in R and more in D, you would be at this 10% rule. And you could argue that even that may or may not be enough to remake a multi-$1 trillion industry with 100% certainty within a decade. Because if you're going to go to that trouble, you're going to say this has got to work. And that means you're going to fund 100 rotten ideas to find one that works. Because that's where we have to be. So Sirius is by any measure on the scale of $30 or $50 billion a year. It's kind of a dime a gallon gas tax. We'd never notice it. Okay? But we'd have to be serious.
Hi, could you please make a comment on a possible use of algae for energy production?
Right.
And did you include that in your MS?
Okay, so algae have the same problem of saturation that plant photosynthesis does. They saturated a tenth of a sun, and the way people get around that is they pump them fast enough they don't see the average sunlight, but you have to count the energy needed for the pumps to do that. On the other hand, my view on this is you should be trying to play all these big cards. If you have three big cards, coal, nuclear, solar, you want to play them all and try to grow technologies and then figure out which ones you're going to deploy, and whether or not it's bioengineering Franken-plants that grow faster and are black instead of green, or co-opting algae to do it, or making it ourselves, or developing a new nuclear cycle, you know, I think you got to do them all, and you got to do them seriously. And so I didn't specify exactly which technology would be that solar 10%-y thing, completely neutral on how you get there, just make it happen.
Yes, my comment with your lecture, which I very much enjoyed, is rather complicated. First of all, Michael Crichton has taken a very interesting contrarian attitude with regard to what humans are doing to the environment, and he calls it the current liberal religion. Getting beyond that and looking at science, if you look at the last several million years, you see a sinusoidal variation in temperature. And right now we're on the upturn or near the peak. Also realize that the carbon that's in hydrocarbons was once in the atmosphere. And even worse, the carbon and carbonaceous rocks, chalk and so forth, was once in the atmosphere. Indeed, the atmosphere was once carbon dioxide.
Well,
but I'd like to just say one thing.
I think you're providing a great segue to what we're going to do next, which is to ask Nate more questions over our reception.
You want me to answer the one thing?
Yeah.
Let me just give you the direct answer. First of all, Michael Crichton is a science fiction writer. Fiction. Secondly, he might be right. He might be right. Do you want to vote that you want to take the risk that he's wrong? Because there's only one way to find out, and it lasts for 3,000 years. Since nobody can predict the future of this, those oscillations were indeed driven by the eccentricity changes of the Earth around the Sun, the Milankovitch cycle. CO2 did not start them. It is believed that CO2 amplified the effect. We don't know that for sure because none of us were there to measure it. We absolutely know that CO2 levels are higher now than they have been in 20 million years. I did not ever say that it would be better, worse, or the same as it was now. I took no scientific prediction on what the outcome of that concentration would be. So I don't disagree that these predictions could be right or wrong, but I told you nobody, including anybody in this room, can scientifically say they can predict the answer. But everybody can say that according to the laws of chemistry and physics, the outcome will last for a timescale comparable to modern human history. So this is about risk management. It is not about science. Thanks.
So please join us in the courtyard where there's some light refreshments. Thanks.